everyone, welcome to Punta Vista. I am Theo, and I am here in a cave approximately 3 million years BA. That's before Avatar. I've got a lovely little rock in my horrible, almost human paws, and when I look at it, I can see the face of a man that I see when I look directly down into a stream, and that makes me feel good. Behind me, leering over me, holding a much larger and pointier rock above his head menacingly in both hands, it's Ben. How are you, buddy?
Oh, I didn't know you knew I was here. I just invented a new thing, exercise.
Jealousy.
Jealous rage. Jealous self-conception.
Going through a lot right
aerobics.
Now.
But, a real threefer.
But, okay, so if I hold this rock above my head, my arms will get bigger somehow.
Yeah, become extremely muscular, yes.
Okay. Will I still look exactly like the man that I see when I look down into the stream?
Yes. Well,
yeah.
I don't know how to explain
but this.
But
my arms will be bigger, though. And
his arms
like
will
now
become...
I'll be able to tell because my arms will be bigger and his arms will still be the same size.
So you know how whenever you look at the man in the stream, he's always looking back at you?
Yeah. And yeah, sort of like a look of recognition. I can kind of, whenever I look directly into his eyes, he's looking back at me.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I kind of see a lot of myself in him.
How much of yourself would you say that you see in him?
I mean, it's hard to know, but we invented the concept of self yesterday, so...
Yeah, we're still coming to terms with that.
It's all quite difficult.
I love that rock with my entire life. I think it is an absolute delight. When you say before Avatar, by the way,
yeah,
is this the film or the television series of the same name?
This would be the film, I think.
Sure, because that's a crucial difference of a couple of years.
It can get a little confusing when you come across literature from the period when they were using before Avatar to mean the TV series. Mm. You kind of do that little self-correction.
Yeah, it's good that what's that? The French science body that's in charge of standardizing all the terms.
Oh, the SI, the
Perverts International. Yeah. When they nailed, we're definitely using the movie. That was good of them because it was very confusing before.
It was. No one knew what the years were, and then Avatar came out, and we've got this sorted.
Yeah.
Hey, would you like to do another episode of the Theo Files?
Theo, I would absolutely love to do.
I'm
an episode
still not
of
100%
Files.
Okay with the title. But...
I love the title very much. Every time I tell people about it, I get a little thrill.
You can kind of see me in your mind's eye just squirming around like the horrible little worm I am.
But that's what I'm picturing it most hours of the day. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's kick off. Ben, can we talk about Ötzi?
Can we talk about what?
Ötzi.
Can you spell that one for me?
Yeah. So we've got a capital O with some umlauts above.
How many?
Two.
Okay.
Standard yep. pair.
Standard form.
Yeah. T-Z-I.
Ötzi?
Ötzi.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about Ötzi.
Ötzi. Ben, we're going to have a great time. Ötzi was found on 19th of September 1991 by two German tourists at an elevation of 3,210 meters on the east ridge of Finnitzbitze in the Ötzl Alps on the Austrian-Italian border. The tourists, Helmut and Erika Simon... we're walking off the path between the mountain passes, Hüsler Bütjic and Tiesenjörg. I'm just reading them as they're spelled.
That's the beauty of the German language, yeah. Is you can do that.
It's completely phonetic. They believed that the body was of a recently deceased mountaineer. The next day, a mountain gendarme and the keeper of the nearby Silmenhütte first attempted to remove the body, which was frozen in ice below the torso using a pneumatic drill and ice axes, but they had to give up due to bad weather. The body was semi-officially extracted on the 22nd of September and officially salvaged the next day. I don't know what distinction they're making.
Are these legal distinctions?
I do not know, but we do get into the legalities of this by the end, all right? So, all right. it was transported to the office of the medical examiner in Innsbruck, together with the objects found. On the 24th of September, the find was examined there by archaeologist Konrad Spindler of the University of Innsbruck, who dated the find to be about 4,000 years old,
so
based
like
on
a...
the typology of the axe among the retrieved objects.
Not very recent, then.
Not very recent.
No.
No. But we'll kind of get into why they thought this was the case.
He's wearing a very stylish modern jacket. Throw them off. This man's wearing Carhartts.
Just through parallel processes, he managed to invent the jacket, the Road Warrior jacket.
It's like, have you seen those? It'd be like photos of Victorian people wearing like freakishly modern looking sunglasses or whatever. Where you're just like, oh, that guy's far too cool to be from the past. Are you sure?
I love Ötzi. I think for my mind, it is the single most interesting corpse ever found.
Wow, that is a huge claim.
Mm-hmm. So they've taken it, they examined it, measured it, x-rayed it, dated it. Tissues and intestinal contents have been examined microscopically, as have the items being found with the body. In August 2004, frozen bodies of three Austro-Hungarian soldiers killed during the Battle of San Mateo in 1918 was found on the mountain of Punta San Mateo in Trentino. One body was sent to a museum in the hope that research on how the environment affected its preservation would help unravel Ötzi's past. So if you look at a photo of how he was discovered, he's basically like half a body sticking out of ice. They found him just completely frozen. He looks mummified, but still recognizably human for something that was killed out in the open and left to the elements, effectively frozen into a glacier, right? So this is why he's so incredible. That I think pretty much straight away, we don't quite know the chronology of it, but he's frozen into in place and left there for thousands of years until this glacier retreated.
He was like snap frozen.
Yeah.
Like some sort of microwave dinner.
Okay, well, if you look at him, he does look like a microwave dinner as well. So just type in Ötzi into your browser, into DuckDuckGo.
I'm going to get a kick out of you saying Ötzi every single time. So even if all else about this story fails to amuse me, know that you have that.
Okay, so at the Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye... Sorry, are you just looking at his horrible microwave dinner body?
I'm looking at the reconstructions of him.
Oh, we'll get into that too.
And he is. He's got a body that will not quit. He looks like he is
Ötzi
made
is
of...
slamming.
You know how in the first... Oh, you've not seen the Hellraiser movies, have you?
No, I've seen the first one, yeah.
Oh, well, in the first Hellraiser movie, how the guy's gradually getting all of his components back and he's just muscles and blood at one point.
Yeah.
It's like if you towed that guy dry. I'm just... In the image results, you know how it like it'll truncate the headline that the image is from? It's just... Ötzi the Iceman has been 3D printed. Dot, dot, dot.
Do not 3D print Ötzi. This is extremely...
it's very disrespectful.
Very disrespectful.
How would you feel if someone 3D printed you? Mm.
All right, so I know what you're thinking. Prehistoric Austrian man. But...
How racist was he?
No. Well, okay. So, but at the Treaty of Saint-Germain-en-Laye in 1919, the border between North and South Tyrol was defined as the watershed of the rivers Inn and Etsch. Near Tiesenjusch, the glacier, which has since retreated, complicated establishing the watershed, and the border was drawn too far north. So although Ötzi's find site drains to the Austrian side, surveys in October 1991 showed that the body had been located 92.56 meters inside Italian territory.
Oh, no.
Prehistoric Italian.
Can I just say?
Hey.
Mamma mia.
Mamma mia. I'm anthropological over here.
Oh, I just love, like, that's a great dispute to have. He's like, that's our Iceman, actually.
that's our Iceman.
I'm going to need you to find your own Iceman. Thank you for digging him out.
We'll take it from here.
Yeah. We're going to get him a nice plate of spaghetti, warm him up, see how he's doing.
All right. So the The province of South Tyrol claimed property rights but agreed to let Innsbruck University finish its scientific examinations. Since 1998, it has been on display. It's very disrespectful. He's a
him,
man.
He,
him.
Yeah.
He has a name, and his name is Utsi.
Utsi?
He's been on display at South Tyrol Museum of Archaeology in Bolzano, the capital of South Tyrol. All right. Let's check out that body.
I would love to check out that body.
So by current estimates, at the time of his death, he was 160 centimetres tall, weighed about 50 kilograms, was about 45 years of age.
Mm.
So just like me. When his body was found, it weighed only 13 and a half kilos. Because the body
What's
was
his
covered...
Secret? He's doing that intermittent fasting, isn't he?
Because the body was covered in ice shortly after his death, it only partially deteriorated. Initial reports claimed that his penis and most of his scrotum were missing, but this was later shown to be unfounded.
I'm sorry?
He's got that dick and balls still.
Later shown to be unfounded. Like someone was like, hey, check if he's got a dick and balls. Nope. Like 5 years later.
Like it went out on TMZ or something.
Yeah, it was just a rumor. It was a rumor that Utsi has no dick and balls. We went straight to the source. It's still there.
So analysis of pollen, dust, grains, and the isotopic composition of his tooth enamel indicated that he spent his childhood near the present village of Feldthurns, north of Bolzano, but later went to live in valleys about 50 kilometres farther north.
Wait, so how did they identify that?
Analysis of pollen, dust, grains, and the isotopic composition of his tooth enamel.
That is fucking amazing.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot more of that coming.
Good Lord. Wait, so the isotopic composition... Are they talking about radiation levels?
I would assume that it's due to the calcium in your teeth would have a certain species of isotope in it. That would be my guess.
All right. And you seem like you know more about this than I do. Mm, so
I don't, but I said it quite confidently.
You did?
So
look in your eyes. Very compelling.
Yeah. It's new meds. In 2009, a CAT scan revealed that the stomach had shifted upward to where his lower lung area would normally be.
Mm.
You don't want that.
You don't.
That's where I do my breathing.
Another thing. I also can't breathe.
Analysis of the contents revealed the partly digested remains of ibex meat and confirmed by DNA analysis, suggesting he had a meal less than 2 hours before his death.
Oh, that's nice.
Wheat grains were also found. Is believed that Utsi most likely had a few slices of a dried fatty meat, probably bacon.
Mm, so he was Austrian then.
which came from a wild goat in South Tyrol. Analysis of Utsi's intestinal contents showed two meals, the last one consumed about 8 hours before his death, one of chamois meat, so that's a goat, it's kind of like a large, sort of like an antelope,
mm-hmm.
The other of red deer and herb bread. Both which was eaten with roots and fruits, right? So this, just from the stomach, we can tell like a gigantic amount about like what people in that area of that time ate, did, like just from what he had in his stomach.
Also,
it's incredible.
Like, so many different, like four
so many
different meats.
So many different things, right? Like I imagine that they just have one thing to eat and that's it. Like
yeah.
Then they just try not to starve until the next
like
one.
Scarcity hunters. They're like, they have a larder of things going on.
Well, that's
on.
Right. And they must have food that occurs over different time spans, right? So they'll eat the meat preferentially or eat the bread over a longer period of time.
Ibex for breakfast.
Ibex for breakfast.
Goat bacon for lunch.
Yeah. Guy was living.
He was.
Yeah, not anymore. No.
He was living right up until the moment where he died and was frozen into a glacier.
That's right. As are we all.
It's so true.
The
glacier's coming for all of us.
The grain also eaten with both meals was a highly processed Einkorn wheat brand. Einkorn, sorry. Quite possibly eaten in the form of bread. In the proximity of the body and thus possibly originating from the Iceman's provisions, chaff and grains of einkorn and barley and the seeds of flax and poppy were discovered, as well as kernels of sloes, which are small fruits from the blackthorn tree, and various seeds of berries growing in the wild. So hair analysis was used to examine his diet from several months before. Pollen in the first...
This is amazing.
They are mining every part of this man.
Scientists.
Oh, Pollen in the first meal showed that he'd been it had been consumed in a mid-altitude conifer forest, and other pollens getting very heady conifer back palate taste.
It's coniferous.
And other pollens indicated the presence of wheat and legumes, which may have been domesticated crops. Pollen grains of hop hornbeam were also discovered. This guy's just eating everything. He's eating his way across Italy.
Or he just had like a couple of packets of jerky and a fruit and nut trail mix on him. He popped out of the shops. He got those like weird
just
brands
one scoop
that aren't
of everything,
quite a brand.
Please.
Yeah.
So the pollen was well preserved with the cells inside remaining intact, indicating that it had been fresh at the time of Uzi's death, which places the event in spring or early summer. Einkorn wheat is harvested in the late summer and slows in the autumn, which so it must have been stored from the previous year.
Oh.
Which is fun.
Yeah.
So high levels of both copper and arsenic were found in his hair. This along with Uzi's copper axe blade, which is 99.7% pure copper, led scientists to speculate that Uzi was involved in copper smelting.
Mm. All right.
Smart man. So, by examining the proportions of his tibia, femur, and pelvis, Christopher Ruff, any rough hands in the audience?
People at home listening to this going, woo!
That's my boy!
My guy! There he is!
So, it indicates that Uzi's lifestyle included long walks over hilly terrain. This degree of mobility is not characteristic of other Copper Age Europeans. So, Ruff proposes that this may indicate that Uzi was a high-altitude shepherd.
And also a coppersmith. This is also quite terrifying to me because I'm thinking about, like, you know at the end of AI, the weird robots that thaw out the child?
Yeah.
I'm picturing those guys finding my body and being like... All right, from looking at his bones, we can tell he was recumbent 90% of the day.
Yeah.
Looking at his stomach.
His dick didn't work.
It was possibly the softest dick in human history. He largely just ate weird chips that he bought from the Asian grocers. Yeah. It seems he had a lethal amount of THC in his bloodstream.
Completely hollow bones.
It looks like he drank 560 litres of beer a day. That doesn't seem right.
All right, so using 3D scanning technology, a facial reconstruction has been created for the South Tyrol Museum of Archaeology. It shows Uzi looking old for his 45 years with deep-set brown eyes, a beard, a furrowed face, and sunken cheeks.
He looks good.
He is depicted looking tired and ungroomed.
I think he looks hot as hell.
Cool slam on Uzi.
He's sort of like if Radagast the Brown did like elderly male modeling.
That is exactly what it is.
Like, he's a little ripped, right? Am I wrong?
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Look at that look that he's given the camera. Although now when you zoom in on his face, get close to the mouth region, it's not quite so enticing, but he looks good.
So, you want to hear what he was wearing this season?
I would love
who
to.
Who he was wearing? So he wore a cloak of woven grass, a coat, a belt, a pair of leggings, a loincloth, and shoes all made of leather of different skins. So you can actually look up, there's a picture of the shoe that's sort of been reconstructed, and it's laced together. It's held together with like straps of like thin straps of leather. Mm-hmm. It's got laces. It looks all the world like a modern kind of shoe. As best you could with, you know, pulling leather together, right?
Yeah, without underpaying
Which
Indonesian children to make them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, the amount of craft that goes into everything that this guy is wearing is mind-boggling to think of, to try and work out how this would come together in a sort of...
Where's he getting the design pattern from?
That's right. So he wore a bearskin cap, leather chin strap.
To keep his hat on.
That's very smart.
Clever, yeah.
The shoes were waterproof and wide, seemingly designed for walking across the snow. They were constructed using a bearskin for the soles, which, again, like, where are you getting a bearskin from? Deer hide for the top panels, and a netting made of tree bark. Soft grass went around the foot and in the shoe and functioned like modern socks.
Oh, my God.
The coat, belt, leggings, and loincloth were constructed of vertical strips of leather sewn together with sinew. His belt had a pouch sewn to it that had a cache of useful items, a scraper, a drill, flint, flake, bone oil, and a dried fungus.
What was that fungus for?
That's for Ron. So the shoes are being reproduced by a Czech academic who said that because the shoes are actually quite complex, I'm convinced that even 5,300 years ago, that's BA, people had the equivalent of a cobbler who made shoes for other people.
Specialization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The reproductions were found to constitute such excellent footwear that it was reported that a Czech company offered to purchase the rights to sell them.
I feel like that shoe should be in the public domain.
Right.
To my mind.
That shoe belongs in a museum.
That shoe does belong in a museum. But also, if you want to make that shoe, you should just be able to Google a print pattern for making Ootsie's shoes.
I feel like the Ootsie patent rights would have expired by now, although knowing Disney.
God damn it. Keep refreezing additional Iceman every 50 years. So like, oh, no. We've maintained the copyright on the Iceman.
All right. So a more recent hypothesis by British archaeologist Jackie Wood says that Ootsie's shoes were actually the upper part of snowshoes. According to this theory, the item currently interpreted as part of his backpack is actually the wood frame and netting of one snowshoe and animal hide to cover the face. The leather loincloth and hide coat were made from sheepskin. Genetic analysis showed that the sheep species was nearer to modern domestic European sheep than to wild sheep.
Oh.
The items were made from the skins of at least four different animals. Part of the coat was made from domesticated goat, belonging to a mitochondrial haplogroup that inhabits Central Europe today. The coat was made from several animals from two different species and was stitched together with hides available at the time. The leggings were made from domesticated goat leather. A similar set of 6,500-year-old BA leggings discovered in Switzerland were made from goat leather, which may indicate that goat leather was specifically chosen. Shoelaces were made from the European genetic population of cattle. The quiver was made from wild roe deer. The fur hat was made from a genetic lineage of brown bear, which lives in the region today. And writing in the journal Scientific Reports, researchers from Ireland and Italy reported their analysis of his clothing's mitochondrial DNA, which was extracted from nine fragments of six of his garments, including his loincloth and fur cap. So he also had a whole bunch of shit with him, right? Which, again, super cool for actually understanding
mm-hmm.
what was going on, what
was his everyday carry?
Right, so he's laying it out. He's showing all that kit. He's got a copper axe with a U handle, a chert bladed knife with an ash handle, and a quiver of 14 arrows with viburnum and dogwood shafts. So they're sort of like little shrubby sort of things. Two of the arrows, which were broken, were tipped with flint and had fletching, so stabilizing fins on them. Very cool. While the other 12 were unfinished and untipped. The arrows were found in a quiver with what was presumed to be a bowstring, an unidentified tool, and an antler tool, which might have been used for sharpening his arrow points. There was also an unfinished yew longbow that was 1.82 meters long.
Holy moly. How tall was he again?
150 centimeters. So this thing is
fucking Christ.
Yeah, is like one and a half times his height. He's just carrying around this bow.
That's wild.
So he also had berries, two birch bark baskets, two species of polypore mushrooms with leather strings through them. So he's just carrying around mushrooms with like a string through them to keep them.
That is amazing.
One of these, the birch fungus, is known to have anthelmintic properties, which is used for medicinal purposes. The other was a kind of tinder fungus included with what appeared to be a complex fire lighting kit. The kit featured pieces of over a dozen different plants in addition to flint and pyrite for creating sparks. So his copper axe is super cool. The haft is 60 centimeters long and made from carefully worked yew with a right angle crook at the shoulder leading to the blade. The 9.5 centimeter long axe, that's 3.7 inches, is made of almost pure copper, produced from a combination of casting, cold forging, polishing, and sharpening. So again, like, that they have all of these techniques coming together in one place, right? Like, I always thought of the Copper Age stuff as being quite localized, you know, I think But there's clearly like a lot of crafts, a lot of specializations emerging, like all in the one place, all at the same time.
All available to this one fucking guy. All available
to this one dude.
Yeah.
Right? Who's just like walking around with all of this shit that he's collected over his 45 years of, you know, prehistoric life. It's very cool. So despite the fact that copper ore sources in the Alpines were known to have been exploited at the time, a study indicated that the copper in the axe came from southern Tuscany, which is, you know, that's a decent hike. It was led into the forked end of the crook and fixed there using birch tar and light leather lashing. The blade part of the head extends out of the lashing and shows clear signs of having been used to chop and cut. At the time, such an axe would have been a valuable possession, important both as a tool and as a status symbol for the bearer. All right, but that's enough of his shit. What about him himself? Mm-hmm. Why don't we go digging into what really made Ötzi tick?
Let's get inside Ötzi.
Let's really get up there. Rearrange Ötzi's guts.
Hit Ötzi's back walls. Oh.
All right, so we've sequenced his genome, which is cool, I guess.
Yep. Which is why, of course, we have that island in Costa Rica with Ötzi World on it.
Just stomping around 100 centimeter, like 170 centimeter tall fences.
There's no way this can go wrong. We've made all of the Ötzi's male. They can't possibly breed.
There's no danger.
We had to fill in some of the gaps in his DNA with frog DNA, though.
So he can jump upwards of 4 meters directly in the air. Just driving through. Ötzi's just smacking against your car window. No, it's fine. As long as you've got 8 or 9 different kinds of berries in your pouch, he'll be satisfied.
Oh, it's like the T-Rex feeding thing, but it's just a single mushroom rising up on the platform.
He doesn't eat it. He just puts it in his pouch for later on. Clever girl. All right. So analysis of his mitochondrial DNA showed that Ötzi belongs to the K1 subclade, which, you know, I mean,
of course,
it makes sense. But it cannot be categorized into any of the 3 modern branches of that subclade, K1A, K1B, or K1C. The new subclade has been provisionally named K1O with umlauts for Ötzi.
Oh, I love that.
He's got his own little subclade.
Oh, he's smiling in hell right now.
That's right. Ötzi was a chronic masturbator. And for that sin...
It's eternal damnation, but he knows that he's been recognized, so he's okay.
Cum stains from his trousers were lifted from... indicating at least 4 different time spans.
Calluses on the penis, which we now know exists.
This is the most wanked dick in history. All right. So a multiplex assay study was able to confirm that Iceman's mtDNA belongs to a previously unknown European mtDNA clade. So that's lowercase mtDNA. I didn't look that one up. With a very limited distribution among modern data sets. So he's most closely related to Southern Europeans, especially to geographically isolated populations like Corsicans and Sardinians. DNA analysis also showed him at high risk of atherosclerosis and lactose intolerance. This is an Ötzi with diarrhea.
It's a huge day for the people at university where they're like, we did it. We found one that has IBS.
We found Lucy's ancestor.
That's everything I know about Lucy. Italian. Can't drink milk.
Those are the 2 things we know. He also had the DNA sequence of Borrelia burgdorferi, possibly making him the earliest known human with Lyme disease.
Jesus Christ.
Or possibly just the earliest known human to claim he has Lyme disease.
Who knows? No one told him you're supposed to take the whole tick out. You can't just leave the head in there.
A later analysis suggested the sequence may have been a different species of Borrelia. So we don't know. In October 2013, it was reported that 19 modern Turellian men were descendants of Uzi.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, like, again, this is super wild to me, right? That we can pick one person who some ice fell on him in a, you know, a mountain.
He tripped on his dick snow climbing.
In Italian Bavaria.
Yeah.
And we can go, well, we can find 19 people that, you know, were related to him.
We can open the phone book and we can say, hey, you, Spinelli. Hey. We found your fucking great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa.
So scientists from the Institute of Legal Medicine at Innsbruck University.
Legal medicine?
Yeah, of Institute of Legal. It's perfectly legal.
The Institute of Illegal Medicine? Horrible place. Very bad.
That's the place that old mate goes to in Jacob's Ladder. Just pushing trolleys around and getting caught up on limbs. That place sucks.
It's not good.
So they analyzed the DNA of over 3,700 Turellian male blood donors and found 19 who shared a particular genetic mutation with the 5,300-year-old man. So in 2012, scientists announced the discovery that Uzi still had intact blood cells. So these are the oldest complete human blood cells ever identified.
Oh, my God.
In most bodies this old, the blood cells are either shrunken or mere remnants, but Uzi's have the same dimensions as living red blood cells and resembled a modern-day sample. Super cool.
That's so nuts.
So, this brings us to, I guess, the end of Uzi's journey.
I feel like the end of his journey was about 3,000 years ago.
Yeah. So the cause of death remains uncertain until 10 years after the discovery of the body. It was initially believed that Uzi died of exposure during a winter storm. Later, it was speculated that Uzi might have been a victim of a ritual sacrifice, perhaps for being a chieftain, which, cool. But this explanation was inspired by theories previously advanced for the first millennium BCE bodies recovered from peat bogs, such as the Tolland Man and the Lindo Man. Go and check out those other classic men.
Some of the iconic men.
Some of the men we know and love. So in 2001, x-rays and a CT scan revealed that Uzi had an arrowhead lodged in his left shoulder when he died, and a matching small tear on his coat. The discovery of the arrowhead prompted researchers to theorize Uzi died of blood loss from the wound, which would probably have been fatal even if modern medical techniques had been available, and they weren't.
They really weren't.
No. This guy just had to kill,
like, saved him.
19 weasels and sew himself a new skin.
If we had the technology from the Michael Crichton book timeline, we could have saved him.
Alas. Further research found that the arrow's shaft had been removed before death, and close examination of the body found bruises and cuts to the hands, wrist, and chest, and cerebral trauma indicative of a blow to the head. One of the cuts was at the base of his thumb that reached down to the bone but had no time to heal before his death. So currently it's believed that Uzi bled to death after the arrow shattered the scapula and damaged nerves and blood vessels before lodging near the lung. Which, again, is where his stomach is now. Yep.
So what you're saying to me is that this was murder most foul.
Murder most foul, but I think I really feel that this is some form of last stand. The last stand of Uzi. Because recent DNA analyses claim that they revealed traces of blood from at least four other people on his gear.
Oh, he got Boromir'd.
Yeah, one from his knife, two from a single arrowhead, and fourth from his coat. Interpretations of these findings were that Uzi killed two people with the same arrow and was able to retrieve it on both occasions, and the blood on his coat was from a wounded comrade he may have carried over his back.
Oh, my God.
This dude is Boromiring it all over Northern Tyrol.
Oh.
Boromir of Italian Bavaria.
We simply must stand this man.
Uzi's posture in death, frozen body, face down, left arm bent across the chest, could support a theory that before death occurred and rigor mortis set in, the Iceman was turned on his stomach in the effort to remove the arrow shaft by perhaps a southern Aragorn, or perhaps even a Italian Aragorn.
Yeah, it was a classic Italian Aragorn situation.
Which brings us to the legal dispute.
Fantastic.
So Italian law entitled the Simon. So this is Helmut and I forget her other what was her name? I'll get to that. So the Italian law entitled the Simons to a finder's fee from the South Tyrolean provincial government of 25% of the value of Uzi.
So you just get your Iceman assessor.
Yeah.
He's assessed all the great Icemen. Richard Kuklinski.
And they classically, they just add like 30% on top just in case your Iceman museum burns down and you need to claim on insurance.
Yeah, it's exactly how the art world works. Your painting is worth $3 million. Mm. Your Iceman.
If
also.
Anything should happen to your Iceman, we all could stand to make a lot of money. So in 1994, the authorities offered a symbolic reward of 10 million lira, which is approximately 5,200 euro, which the Simons declined. Well, I think they're going for the dollars.
No. They didn't decline it out of like a this belongs to
the
world.
They've
gone fucking pay up, motherfucker.
That's exactly right.
Oh, right.
We didn't find Uzi to stay penniless.
I'd like to retract the appreciative noise that I made.
In 2003, the Simons filed a lawsuit which asked a court in Bolzano to recognize their role in Uzi's discovery and declare them his official discoverers. The court decided in the Simons' favor in November 2003. At the end of December that year, the Simons announced that they were seeking a US $300,000 as their fee. Kind of an Uzi finder's fee.
Yeah. They didn't find him on purpose. They didn't go...
You don't know that.
It's time to go up on the mountain and find Uzi the Iceman. Oh, I hope we find him today.
But really, what an attitude to have, though. Waking up every morning with the thought that you might just find Uzi the Iceman.
You sit there eating your cornflakes, being like, today's the day I find, for the first time, Uzi the Iceman. And I believe that is the plot of the movie about the secret that's been released at the moment. I think that's more or less it.
So the provincial government decided to appeal. In addition, two people came forward to claim that they were part of the same mountaineering party that came across Uzi. And this is wild. All right. So Magdalena Mohajak, a retired Slovenian climber who alleged that she discovered the corpse first after falling into a crevice. Mm-hmm. Hey, that looks like Uzi the Iceman!
Who among us hasn't been so distracted by spotting Uzi the Iceman that we slip into a crevice? Oh, holy fuck!
It's shortly after returning to a mountain hut. Guys, you are not going to believe this. I fell into a crevice immediately after discovering Uzi the Iceman.
People just like completing a sentence. You guys, I found Uzi the Iceman. You found him. Yes, that was a very good guess.
So after returning to the mountain hut, asked Helmut Simon to take photographs of Uzi. She cited Reinhold Messner, who is also present in the mountain hut, as the witness to this. Sandra Nemeth from Switzerland, who contended that she found the corpse before Helmut and Erika Simon, and that she spat on Uzi to make sure her DNA would be found on the body later.
That is...
disrespectful... Do not.
It's rude. You didn't have like a bit of paper on you. You couldn't just be like, leave this here. Oh my god.
You could just crack off a finger or something.
That's some weirdly like extreme lateral thinking.
Yeah. So she later asked for a DNA test on the remains, but experts believe that there was little chance of finding any trace. On the 29th of September 2008, it was announced that the provincial government and Mrs. Simons had reached a settlement of the dispute, under which she would receive 150,000 euro in recognition of Uzi's discovery by her and her late husband and the tourist income that it attracts.
Helmut didn't live to see the Uzi money come in?
No, didn't see the Uzi money or, I guess, the appreciation of finding Utsi.
The recognition.
The recognition of finding Utsi the Iceman.
I've always said that finding Utsi the Iceman is its own reward. Who needs 150,000 euro when you could be drunk at a bar?
You'd be on cloud nine, wouldn't you?
Oh, God. Anytime you're out in public.
You'd never pay for a beer again.
You'd walk up, you'd just like elbow somebody. Like,
I haven't been this thirsty since the time I discovered Utsi the Iceman. Oh, you're Erica Simon. I should have known.
Oh, it's cold in here. That reminds me. I tell you what, that bartender sure looks a lot like Utsi the Iceman, who I discovered, by the way.
Yeah, who I've seen.
I saw him first, incidentally.
Well.
In a while.
In a while.
Yeah. Not since the Urukai or whatever tried to kill him.
Yeah. But Utsi, I think, is having the last laugh from his horrible little lungs, which are also a stomach.
From the pit of his combined lung stomach.
Kind of the cloaca of the organs.
Why don't you just, you know, they do the same thing. They take stuff in, they push stuff out.
It's basically the same organ.
I also think that's what the heart does. And those are all the organs that I can think of. Whatever the kidney does, probably the same.
So, influenced by the curse of the pharaohs and the media theme of cursed mummies, claims have been made that Utsi is cursed.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The allegation revolves around the deaths of several people connected to the discovery, recovery, and subsequent examination of Utsi. It is alleged that they have died under mysterious circumstances.
Uh-huh.
These people include co-discoverer Helmut Simon and Konrad Spindler, the first examiner of the mummy in Austria in 1991. To date, the deaths of seven people, of which four were accidental, have been attributed to the alleged curse. In reality, hundreds of people were involved with the recovery of Utsi and are still involved in studying the body and artifacts found. You cannot swing a cat in the Utsi examination
room. Without hitting a live person who has examined Utsi the Iceman?
It's been running on Broadway for 12 years. Sold out crowds. The fact that a small percentage of them have died over the years has not been shown to be statistically significant. That's the tale of Utsi the Iceman.
Can I add a little postscript to this story? What I'm going to do is something I would normally never do. I'm going to read some tweets for you. These are tweets from Sydney comedian and radio producer Max Laverne.
Oh, the beautiful Max.
Prawn underscore meat. Mm-hmm. This first one, dated January 28th, 2019. Utsi the Iceman died because he threw his back out making that ass clap. this is another tweet, also from January 28th, 2019.
It's on a real Utsi bender.
An Utsi on the brain. I'm so fucking sick of people talking about no-talent celebrities like Utsi the Iceman, who are only famous for being mummified on the Austrian-Italian border around 5,000 years ago.
Okay, full disclosure. I think I know about Utsi the Iceman because of Max Laverne's
tweets. I think I might also as well. May 24th this year, a lot of people credit Utsi the Iceman with getting them into Iceman. Oh, I love that man very, very much. I like that pattern as well. So these are like the only tweets he's ever done about Utsi the Iceman. He did two of them on one day.
He's on a roll.
And then like 5 months later, he's like,
oh, fuck, I'm still
thinking about him again.
Going back to that well.
3 a.m. Going back to the fridge for more Utsi the Iceman jokes.
Oh, Lord.
So I've got a story for you.
Oh, please.
Now, I've done no real research here. What okay. I've done is I've looked at an article that I've read multiple times because it's the gift that keeps on giving. And I thought, what if I read it to my friend Theo?
Oh, beautiful. Recontextualize it, if you will.
Yes. I'll take it from the context of me reading it inside my own head.
And kind of going,
To reading it aloud on a podcast. So there is a very real chance you might have read this. This is an article from The New Yorker from 2014. I'm not going to tell you what the title of the article is.
Don't want to give away the game.
But I believe the first word you will know immediately whether you have read this article or not.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Shingy believes in storytelling. Have you read this one?
Look, I don't know.
Let's find out together.
Okay.
More story, less telling. A story can be anything. Text or image, 6 seconds or 13 hours. According to Shingy, a story can be anything,
yeah.
But not 5 seconds.
No.
It's got to be six.
That's just it has to surpass the amount of time that it takes for you to stop feeling time as the present and to distinguish it as past and future, which is between 3 and 8 seconds, I think.
Yeah, six.
Yeah.
6 to 8.
Anything shorter than that is just a thing.
If you've not done a full-length Vine, it's not a story.
It's not a story. Vine, classically a story.
Vine, also still a relevant current cultural touchpoint. According to Shingy, we are no longer living in the age of information. It's the age of social, and social is all about conversations.
So true.
How does Shingy know? Because he is a digital prophet. Literally. His business card has a microchip embedded in it, and it reads, Digital Prophet, AOL.
How would anyone know that?
I think it's written on there. It's not on the microchip. I think the microchip is incidental.
Yeah, it's just the microchip's just got like a DivX of second Lord of the Rings
movie.
It's
got a WinRAR installed on there, which can be very useful if you need that.
Very useful. It's got Lero.exe on it.
It also says David Shing, but unless you knew him when he was a kid in Australia, you should just call him Shingy. Which is also his Twitter handle.
I'm not going to do that.
And his URL.
If I meet David Shing, I'm going to say, hello, David.
Hi, David. Or even Mr. Shing.
Mr. Shing.
AOL pays him a six-figure salary for doing what, exactly? Watching the future take shape across the vast online landscape.
Yeah, I do that every day.
Every single day.
And I'm only paid possibly five figures.
I fly all around the world and go to different conferences, so you don't do that.
No, that's true.
No one does that at the moment.
I'm classically groundbound. Real ground lubber.
Last month, he was in Singapore, Brazil, and Germany. I listen to where media is headed and figure out how our brands can win in that environment. In 2002, AOL had more than 25 million subscribers. It now has fewer than 2.5 million. Shingy calls it a, quote, company in transition. There is no typical day for me, Shingy, who is 44, said, which, if you think about it, means that today is pretty typical.
That is extremely aggravating.
That's the worst. Also, it's a paradox. You have a fucking typical day. Shut the fuck up. He arrived at AOL headquarters in the village, wearing black nail polish and high-top sneakers with leather wings. His jacket, t-shirt, and pants were black, and he had decorated them with wide stripes of white paint. He wears his hair up and out, like Phyllis Diller or Beetlejuice.
The fuck is Phyllis Diller?
Isn't Phyllis Diller... Oh, no, I've definitely got this wrong. I was thinking he was one of the people from the Golden Girls, but there's no way that's right.
No. I'm just going to hold on to Beetlejuice, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's a good touch point. You'd be surprised how easy it is to get it to stay like this, actually. A blow dry and then a quarter-sized dab of product, Shingy explained. It's all in the cut, not the styling. He ran into a Ward Cleaver-ish advertising executive named Jim Norton. My man, Shingy said, offering his trademark three-part handshake, ending in a hug.
Handshakes have one part.
One part,
it's
yep.
the part where you shake.
You shake the hand,
yeah.
And then you disengage.
You're done.
Yeah. The worst thing about...
How do you know if you're a part of a three-part handshake right now? How do you know...
Like, he's saying right handshake, now we might be in the...
No, but a handshake that you're engaging in, how do you know that it's part one of three?
It's true. But, I mean, this is the problem with it, right? It's very obnoxious to have this confected thing where you're like, I kind of have my own handshake that I do.
Yeah.
You have to teach it to people. Kind of the idea of the handshake.
It's sort of natural... universal gesture.
And generally it's a way of like meeting new people.
Yeah. And this is really just slowing down the... He must meet tens, if not hundreds, of people a day. And every single person he meets, he gets to part two of his fucked up handshake. And goes, well, hang on, sorry. Wait, we've got to go through this. All right, so you do this, and then, all right, and then kind of teach him. It seems...
I feel like extremely tedious. You know how the IKEA booklets are meant to be like cross language?
Yeah.
It's just like very simple. He's got one of those for the handshake. He's like, look at this. Come back to me when you've read it. Boom, bam, bam. Done. Out of there. It's very obnoxious. Next, Shingy stopped by the office of Erica Nardini, the chief marketing officer of AOL Advertising, and handed her an iPad mini. Wanted to show you a little brain fart I had on the plane, he said. It was a cartoon he had drawn of a bear wearing zebra print pants and a shirt covered in ones and zeros.
What? So what is this for?
Oh, just you wait. Love it, love it, love it, Nardini said. I'm thinking of the bears more as a metaphor. 1,000%, Shingy said.
So I have read this article, which makes it even more maddening now that I'm listening to it again.
Can you imagine?
There is a reason that your company is in the shitter.
And it's exactly this guy.
100% whatever is occurring right now.
I just imagine if you're like a third party witnessing this. Like you are like a lower level employee in this business and you watch that exchange happen and you're just like, holy fuck.
Yeah, we are doomed.
Yeah.
This is not good. I will also say that even though, you know, I'm a bit of a tech head, bit of a tech boy.
Yeah, sure.
I love my bits and my bytes.
Yep.
Classically, ones, zeros, the whole gamut.
Yep.
I'm sticking with that pronunciation.
I'm not going to correct you.
Every futurist is the most tedious person on the face of the planet.
That's correct, yes.
Every single one of them should be rounded up, tried under... We can try them under, like, the witchcraft laws for, you know, telling the future or whatever.
Yeah, there's probably some of those still on the books. Books. Yeah.
Exactly. And just burn them at the stake.
Yeah, and that's fair.
Unless... And I really think that in, like, 2020, that's something that we can all get around. We're divided as a people, as a world, more divided than ever. And what I'm saying is that to bring us together, we can just round up everybody who has the word futurist in their LinkedIn profiles.
Mm-hmm.
And just set fire to them.
We could probably take out the entrepreneurs while we're at it as well.
The entrepreneurs, the...
gurus?
Yeah, gurus are gone.
Anyone that's
gurus
a white-collar worker that has guru
yep.
in their job description on LinkedIn,
yep.
you're out. You're
if
gone.
If you're a code ninja...
Oh, yeah.
That's cut off at the knees.
Rockstar developer of some kind.
Terrible.
You're out of there. You're gone.
And the teentrepreneurs will be tried under adult law.
They deserve it, certainly. Shingy is my muse, Nardini said. During this conversation,
I know too many of these people.
Which ones? On which end of the relationship is the person that you're familiar with?
The non-Shingy entity in this relationship.
Most entities on this planet, non-Shingy
Yeah,
ones.
You could divide them into Shingy and non-Shingy.
It's not a very useful sort of semantic knife to divide the world up into, but you certainly can.
You know,
you're at guess the... who? And you're just like, is it Shingy? No.
No. Wow, right, that narrows it down. Go upstairs at the club, go to the toilet. There's just one that's just got massive hair. You know, that's the Shingy bathroom.
You go in there, there's just no toilet. There's soft music playing and an
empty
white cube.
We've reinvented the toilet.
You can just sort of put your piss or your shit anywhere.
Yeah.
It's not our problem. Oh, there's something about, like, I think the complete emptiness of everything to do with corporate life makes people crave
yeah.
some, like, they're very willing to read genius into the actions of someone that's influencing them to be like, no, I'm part of something special.
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, it's very depressing. Shingy is my muse, Nardini said. During this conversation, Shingy was distracted by his phone, but he looked up and smiled every few seconds.
Yeah, we're all there.
Yep. That's how conversations work now, actually. I lean on him really heavily for the feel of what's happening in the here and now. There is something so polarizing about Shingy, but also so unifying. Yeah, it's that everyone fucking hates him. Every single person that's ever met him that isn't some, like, coked out executive is like...
Yeah, I like to kill you with a hammer.
Hey, can we go to a stairwell and then can I push you down that stairwell? Be a really great use of my time. Shingy kept moving. He's passionate about spaces. And when a space is not working...
One of the classic dimensions. Space, time.
Temporal dimensions of no interest to him. When a space is not working, he reboots it. Why do people talk like this?
No, it's not a...
We have words for like redecorating a room.
Again, they have constructed an entire culture around the fact that they have to spend their lives like this.
Yeah. This is my lot. I am going to wear a fucking shirt and tie every day of my goddamn life until I fucking retire. Let's pretend that it's exciting. I'm going to do that by getting the single worst human being alive to take the desk out of my office. When a space is not working, he reboots it, taking everything out and starting over. He said, "This is a space I recently rebooted for Tim," meaning Tim Armstrong, the CEO of AOL. The room had been a standard fluorescent lit office. Now the desk was gone, replaced by leather armchairs in a circle, and the walls were painted dark grey. Armstrong entered, wearing a fleece, baggy jeans, and loafers. Shingy is short and slight, and Armstrong, who played lacrosse in college, towered over him. I don't give a fuck what he played in college.
Who cares?
That is the most irrelevant detail I can possibly imagine.
I played WoW in college. You don't bring that up in my profile.
"Do you like the scent?" Shingy said. "A diffuser releases a fragrance."
A room should not have a scent. My ideal is... No, we can get into this into the next episode. We will. I feel like we've really kind of landed on the no smell is good smell.
And this has nothing to do with how much weed I smoke. I am a huge nut for filling the house with the smell of incense at all times.
Okay.
I absolutely love it.
Fascinating.
I go wild for it. I love a good smell.
Really?
Yeah, because you know how you get smell blind to the same smells over and over?
Yeah.
So I'm mixing it up. Got lots of different incenses. I like a scented candle, given the opportunity.
I'm closed off to new possibilities.
Yes.
And that's the way I like it.
That's true of you in nearly every single regard. The one minor change you've allowed to happen in your life is you're about to have a child.
Yes.
And that's just a tiny little...
I think it's a sort of, basically a rounding error as far as...
You're going to have zero new things and you accidentally went up to one.
0.4, I feel. Yeah.
A diffuser released fragrance called London, designed by Tom Dixon, into the air. Shingy's office features another of Dixon's scents, Orientalist.
Mm.
But Armstrong... not sure about that one.
Ah, the racist scent.
It smells vaguely of like 1930s racism in here. That's strange. It's funny, Armstrong said. I thought it was the cleaning materials. The cleaning lady was in here last night and I'm like, I love the smell of this table. And she was like, okay. I think the cleaning lady was very right to do that.
Yeah.
I still need to put some sound in here, Shingy said.
Again, I prefer...
I don't think a meeting room needs sound in it.
No. No office space needs sound in it.
No.
It's annoying already.
Yes.
Just leave it be.
Don't try and make them more pleasant either, because you're just encouraging people to spend more time in them. Armstrong looked around. I have meetings here, and people don't know where to sit, he said. They'll figure it out, man, Shingy said. He took an Uber car uptown to IPG Media Brands, an advertising firm, where he was due to give a speech. I think some folks from Applebee's are going to be in the house, he said. I'm more of a caffeine-free, gluten-free, raw food sort of guy. I am able to find something to like in every brand once I hear their story. So you're a psycho. No one has ever liked a brand.
No. Brand stories, brand identity.
Those sort of words make me want to throw up.
Horrible. Absolutely horrible.
I think nothing makes me angrier now than just seeing ads.
Yeah.
I mean, there are,
Oh, absolutely. We've somehow managed to, I don't see ads in my day-to-day life. So when I do see an ad, I go... This is repulsive.
Why are you doing this to me?
This is awful.
I don't need anything.
No.
Please stop. Fucking seeing TV ads makes me want to fucking hurl. Just like, it's so, everything about it, so patronizing, so awful. Horrible way to live. He told the Applebee's people to make their brand, that to make their brand, quote, remarkable, reactive, and relevant, they have to tell stories in real time. Everyone is talking about Solo Mo, social local mobile, but they should be talking about Homo. Home/mobile, cell phones used on the couch. Why do you think that terminology didn't take off? This was in 2014. Homo was a slur back then as well.
Can we start talking about Homo, please?
Hey, I feel like not enough people these days are talking about Homo. How many apps does the average person have? Shingy asked the crowd. 42? Justin Colavita, a media planner, said.
Yeah, cool joke. It's that number. It's the nerd number.
From the thing that a property that I love, but you're not allowed to talk about because people will ruin it for you.
That's right.
That's right, Chingy said. 41, actually. A colleague turned to Colavita and asked, how did you know that? I was just guessing, Colavita said. I must be a prophet. And that is a small snippet into the life of David Ching, who, as I found out today, only left AOL, well, which is now Verizon, I think, last year.
Just think of how much money you're going to make in your entire life. And think of how much money Shingy made being hired at irrelevant AOL on its downslide, like backsliding towards irrelevance. They still like managed to pay him possibly several millions of dollars, right?
I will say absolutely yes.
Yeah.
That is heinously depressing.
For him to go from place to place and turn offices into a zebra or something.
Just to make the things that people were doing before unworkable.
Yeah.
It's just such a... There are lots of reasons to be angry at capitalism. You know, most of them to do with how the poor are treated. But also, how just a very small handful of absolutely just the worst dipshits are hyper-rewarded.
Yeah.
Because they're very willing to be like, I fucking suck, and you need that. And people go, yes, I do.
Just people born without the shame gland.
Yeah.
I got two of them.
And I'm so sorry. I know life is very hard for you. You got the one that Shingy didn't.
I'm very ashamed of
they
it.
They switched your shame glands at the hospital. So this one's going to... did we already give him... No, I guess not. All right. In we go. Oh, well, that concludes episode 3 of the Theo Files.
Yeah, I would say thank you, but...
No, that's fair. what are the common themes between those two stories, you reckon? Weird
style.
Hair.
Style.
Yep. Very similar fashion
very
sensibilities.
Very similar fashion sets.
Both of them probably love mushrooms, am I right?
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yep. Well, thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.